May it please the court.
Proceed, please.
Molly Odom for Mr. Stephen Scher. Mr. Scher was found guilty by a jury of defrauding Continental Airlines by using unauthorized waiver tickets from Continental to sell reduced fare airline tickets. He has raised three issues on appeal, and I would like to address the second and third issue related to the loss and restitution calculations and rely on the briefs for the first issue. Mr. Scher is challenging the method of the loss and restitution calculations, and this court considers that under de novo review. As this court recently stated in United States versus Klein, we consider de novo how the district court calculated the loss because it is an application of the guidelines. Under the guidelines, when the loss is property, as in this case, the loss is determined by the fair market value of the particular property at issue. Here, the record clearly reflects that the district court did not determine the loss based on the fair market value of the tickets. Instead, the court accepted Continental's loss calculations based on the highest Y8 full coach fare.
Now, let's talk about that just for a second. As I understand the record, Ms. Odom, that may have been the first calculation, but then it was sent back and Mr. Scher was given certain adjustments post-trial to include discounts that may have been available on the dates of issue of the waivers, of the waiver tickets, and in fact, that included about $92,000 in credit to the, I believe that is the...
The $1.3 million.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
And then almost $800,000 credit to the relevant conduct amount.
Yes, sir.
Would you just tell me, you know, it's incongruent to what you just finished saying, so please
right.
let me know what the,
right.
what the
it
record
is,
shows.
It is true that the figures were adjusted after the trial, and they were adjusted to take into account advanced ticket purchases. That's per the government's statements at the sentencing hearing. The government stated that they were adjusted to reflect, for example, tickets that were purchased 7 days in advance or 14 days in advance, which would make a difference in that fare. However, both the district court and the government admitted that they acknowledged that they were using the highest fares, even with those adjustments. So you had the discount for advanced purchases, which were recognized, but still, among the array of fares available, Continental continued to use the highest of the Y8 coach fares.
Okay.
And at in the transcript, the district court starts by saying, it's my understanding that they used the highest fares, what they could charge theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at 1948 in the sentencing transcript. And the government says that's correct and confirms that they were using the fares from the Continental system.
Did you supply any countervailing evidence?
Mr. Scher provided some evidence, and it was from a consulting group, the Boyd Consulting Group, which showed, using the figures that were presented at trial during that period from March through June, they used the average coach fares. The problem with that, with the figures that the defense provided, was that it was not clear in the record how far in advance those tickets were purchased. So as a result of that, because they couldn't tell if the consultant had used, for example, a 15-day advance purchase.
Or 30 or 6
exactly,
months or whatever.
Exactly, which would make a significant difference. But Mr. Scher did make a fair representation that Continental's figures were inflated. In fact, when he was talking about it, when he was specifically talking about it at sentencing and said, each time I used a waiver code, I would look at the fares available, and there would be three, sometimes as many as 10. And that's what prompted the district court at sentencing to ask, well, government, what do you say to this? What do you say to the fact that these figures may be artificial and that they do not reflect the fair market value?
Now, Ms. Odom, the question that I have is, you know, obviously this is the evidence that went in. The judge knew about it, and he found that to be a reasonable amount, albeit the high value. Now, how do we get around that, legally speaking?
Right, right. The problem is the record clearly reflects the court used, the district court used the wrong legal standard. We're not asking this court to address the numbers. We're asking this court to address the legal standard that the court said it was using at the sentencing hearing. The district court stated, it didn't matter, and I'm quoting here, what is actually happening in the real world. The fare might be ridiculous, but this is the call of the owner as to what he or she might desire. That is not the guideline standard. The guideline standard is what is the fair market value, what is the actual loss, not Continental choosing a highest fare.
Do you know, when we, this is a long time ago, but the owner always had a right to opine the fair market value of, say, a vehicle or a house or whatever. And that could be high, it could be low, it could be any place, in fact. And then it would have become a jury decision to decide whether that's a reasonable amount. The question I have is, didn't the judge make that determination as far as the loss value and the restitution amount?
I believe that the judge made that determination based on the wrong legal standard. Okay. He asked the wrong question. Fine. Instead of asking what's the fair market value, he asked what does Continental desire.
And how would you determine the fair market value?
The fair market value, I believe that Continental has the ability to do that. Given the fares that the Continental agent testified that he had access to, and given the stature of Continental, I believe that they have and could create the fair market value. However, if, again, we would look to the guidelines, if that is too complicated, then the guidelines direct that we look to a reasonable estimate given the available fares. In this case, we do have several fares that are available, and a reasonable estimate should be gleaned from that. And examples in the guidelines say, such as the average loss to each victim. So perhaps it would be a median from those fares that the Continental employee said he had access to. And he testified that he always chose the highest of the Y8 coach fares.
And what is your position with how overinflated this figure is? I mean, well, do you have an idea that it was, several hundred thousand dollars over, or
I believe
what,
that
how much do you think it's inaccurate?
Right.
Did you figure it out upon some other theory that you came up with regard to how to calculate damages?
No, I do believe that there is an example in the record when Needles was testifying. He was a travel agent through which these tickets were issued. And when he was on the stand, he was not a co-defendant, but he was a government's witness. He gave an example of some of the defendants that were listed in the indictment. And he said, for example, Mr. Fabricant's airfare would have sold for about $1,300 to $1,400. And the Continental Airlines agent said that, according to his records, that would be $2,200. Now, when we're talking about the enormous number of tickets they used for relevant conduct in this case, keep in mind we're looking at two figures. The $1.2 million is the restitution amount and the amount in the indictment. However, they added almost 4,000 additional tickets to that from a couple of years prior when he had been selling waiver codes. So we are talking about a significant difference, even if we're talking about a couple of hundred to $300 to $500 difference. And I would also like to
Coming down here, did you go to the Internet to get your ticket, or did you fly on government rate?
I did look at the Internet. I looked at it to see what Continental
would... Don't answer his question.
what would it charge me to fly yesterday? I did.
Don't give him the...
coming back to something Judge Garza said, in United States versus Olas, in that case, the government's witness... in their testimony that they provided was based on, they provided figures for the stock if it had been bought at top market prices. And this court recognized that that was fine to use that in the guilt proceedings to establish guilt, but it's another matter to use that same figure as the amount of loss that should be attributed to the defendant. They reversed and remanded to say, go back and get a figure that is grounded, use an analysis that's grounded in economic reality. You can't just pull that top figure. You really must make an effort to bring a reasonable estimate.
Now, were a lot of these tickets round-trip tickets? That's the other question I had.
Yes.
They're cheaper if you buy a round-trip as opposed to one-way, and the calculation only
was only one-way.
One-way, so right. The tickets were higher if it was one way, right, as opposed to some of them that were, right, actually round trip.
Now, there is a point when purchasing tickets when those two figures can become the same, like on the same day. It would be just as much to pay for round trip as one way. However, again, there are still a variety of fares available, depending on how full the plane is and a number of factors.
Do we know, or was it taken into account when the flight took place, when the purchase was made and when the flight took place? In other words, did the defendant sell these the day before the flight or two weeks before the flight? Yes. Is that another factor that...
Yes, and Continental used that. That was one of the reasons why they had to go back and readjust the figures, because although in Exhibit 58 it shows that tickets were purchased 11 days in advance, some of them as much as 21, he always used the same-day purchase. And so their data reflects the date of purchase and the date of flights. Yes, sir.
Okay. I guess we have your argument, unless there's something else.
One other point I'd like to make quickly is the government argued in its brief that the restitution was on plain error, and I'm not clear why. I just want to point out that Mr. Scher did object prior to the hearing. And in writing, it's docket number 50, that he objected to the restitution amount. And I just wanted to clarify that point. I didn't know if you had questions on that or not.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Ms. Hutter. And we'll tack on 3 minutes to your 5 minutes if you need it. Mr. McConnell.
May it please the Court, Ryan McConnell on behalf of the United States, First, I'd like to address a question that Judge Prado asked, and that is whether the price of two one-way tickets is more than the price of a round-trip ticket. And there was testimony during the trial from Alan Needle that they were actually the same price when you looked at the full fare for two one-way versus a round-trip. So I don't think that made a difference. The bigger question that I think the panel is concerned about is why should you use this number that Continental came up with? And the answer, the real easy answer, is that is the number that Mr. Scher used when he was trying to figure out how much to charge his customers. He said this during the trial, and he said it during the sentencing. What he did is he looked at the full price fare and then what he could get the waiver ticket at, and then figured out an amount over that amount that he could charge his customers. Why would you use...
So it's based on the record and the admissions of the defendant himself.
Yes, exactly.
But why is that a measure of market value lost to the at all? I mean, it strikes me as just, this is all just fictional. Why don't you deal with the reality of the airline market, which everybody flying knows? I mean, it's just... I don't know anybody that pays that full price.
He was
unless it's just an emergency. It's very limited. I mean, the loss to this airline is these numbers can't represent the loss to the airline in any fair assessment. You may be coming up with some other number that is fair to give this guy who's cheating, but the guidelines say. We're asking here about sentencing and how much what the real loss is. Would those people have been on the plane if they hadn't gotten the cheap fare? The airline would be flying empty.
I respectfully disagree, Judge Higginbotham. Maybe not Mr. Scher's customers wouldn't have been on the plane, because the only reason they went to him is because he was able to get those discounted fares. But when you look at the testimony...
But put aside that last comment of mine. That's another problem with loss. I'll accept that you accept the true market value of the tickets that he deprived them of. But I'm still troubled with how you get to that fair market value using this fixed figure, maybe I misunderstood the record. They use this high figure, which does not represent the cost of those tickets.
They used the full fare coach price of the tickets, and when Mr. Barry Krause testified during the trial, he said that when he went through and looked at the application of those waiver codes, every code that was used for the fare was within the 7-day period. So I think that's an accurate number to use for Continental to say, look, these folks would have paid the full coach fare if they hadn't gotten the waiver code deal from Mr. Scheer. And that's the number that when you talk about market, I mean, Mr. Scheer knew the market, right? He'd worked in the travel agency. He'd done these waiver deals before. That's the number that he was using. That's the number that he came up with as the actual cost of the plane tickets. That's his own number. He said that in, during the trial, and he said that during the sentencing. You look at page 6 of our brief, we have a quote of where he noted that during the trial. And the other big thing that the court should consider is Mr. Scheer came up with no alternatives. Continental, the victim in the case, looked at their actual loss, what these tickets would would have sold for, and then he has this information. He went to trial in June of 2007 and was convicted. This information, Mr. Barry Krause was cross-examined on his loss calculations during the trial. So they had that. He was sentenced in April of 2008. Over almost a year, they had this information where they could have tried to come up with some reasonable way to challenge Continental's loss calculation, and they didn't. And, you know, when Mr. Scheer was asked how he came up with his calculation, which was around $140,000 versus $1.2 million, which was half of the amount that was forfeited out of his account for the counts of conviction in the indictment. So his loss calculation was half the money that he got out of the scheme. I think Judge Hoyt rightly out of hand rejected that. And then no one could really explain how the Boyd Group came up with their calculations, whether it was comparing apples and apples. And I think Judge Hoyt was left with the testimony that Mr. Scheer used this loss calculation when he calculated how much, used the ticket calculation, I apologize, for determining how much he was going to charge his customers, and that's what the actual victim lost. I don't think the Olis case is dispositive in this case, because in that case, the district court did not consider market forces. It's like comparing apples and oranges. That was an accounting fraud case, and the district court didn't consider external market factors which caused the Dynegy stock to drop. And there was testimony during the sentencing that before the disclosure of the accounting fraud, the stock had gone down like two-thirds or something like that. And this court recognized that the district court should have considered the external market forces on the stock drop to determine what the loss was in that case. We just simply don't have that here. I mean, this is much more clear-cut with these airline tickets. And I think the way that Judge Hoyt considered the loss was fair, appropriate, and got to the right result.
What is the standard of review? You say clear error because it was a factual finding. They said they made an objection, so it shouldn't. It seems that
our position is the law, an application of a guideline principle would be de novo, but the calculation, his looking at these loss numbers and figuring out what the loss was, would be clear error.
It's a factual determination.
Correct. Correct. That's our position.
It seems to me that there's another principle that usually goes through these things. When you have a situation which is admittedly difficult for anybody to come up with a number that is objectively reasonable, at least from my understanding of the record, the question then becomes, well, it's sort of a default rule. Who bears the consequences of the difficulty of proof? And I suppose that the argument would be that it ought to fall on the wrongdoer, not on the government. And so, I'll turn the question over. Why is it the government's burden to demonstrate this loss, or whose burden is it?
It's the government's initially, Your Honor, to come forward with by preponderance of the evidence.
You've got to come forward. You have to come forward with a baseline of some kind that is,
yes, Your Honor,
sufficiently credible to carry it in the absence of anything else. But what do we do when based on this record, there really is one other than just the wild estimate?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree with the second part of your question based
on the record. I know you do. I just
if the government I think the court would have to look at the record and look at what the government set forth. If, obviously, here's another hypothetical.
I assume that on this record there really isn't a way to come up with a fairly accurate amount of loss. You can take the extremes, the base and the question is, what do you do with that? What do we do with that?
Assuming
what the district court did is throw up his hands and just take
I don't think the district court did that, though. If you look through the whole sentencing, this court, Judge Hoyt carefully considered the two methodologies proposed to him. I mean, if you look, Judge Hoyt even gave this defendant acceptance of responsibility, which, I mean, if you read the record, this defendant went to trial and up through sentencing, he maintained he did nothing wrong. I mean, Judge Hoyt gave everyone the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, I think I would caution the court to take a couple of comments that he made out of context when he's considering Mr. Shear's number of 140,000 and saying, well, you know, this looks like a pretty big difference here. And then he goes through and says, I don't have it right in front of me, but if you look through the sentencing, he makes the statement that Judge Garza made, that, look, a property owner has the right to charge what he wants to for his property to set the fair market value. That's in his...
Well, sure, but that's not what Continental is not really... That may be some reference point, but it is not... I don't understand that Continental... I understand they're in good faith. Well, here's what this figure is, and you figure it out. I mean, that's what I read them saying, and it's what the law says. They don't say that they really lost that much money. I don't believe there's any dispositive evidence to indicate that something untoward is being presented to the court by Continental. Continental simply saying these are my fares. This is what the fare would be at 2 days, let's say, prior departure. Therefore, determining what the, quote, loss would be, the court cannot then say, well, since they don't always charge it, let me just pick a number below and go with that. I don't have a way of picking a number, and that's the difficulty of the problem here. So, I mean, that's what the court said, and so he picked a number.
Well, I disagree with the last part, Judge Higginbotham. I think that the court said, look, this is what Mr. Shear said the tickets were worth. This is how he figured out his amount. This is what Continental and Mr. Shear seem to be on the same page. Now it's sentencing. He's saying it should be $140,000. Look, he forfeited $280,000, twice that amount as a result of the scheme. That's what he got out of it. So clearly we're not going to use the 140. And no one understands what this Boyd group did. Mr. Shear admitted on the record he didn't even understand what the Boyd group did. So we're left with what Mr. Shear used, what the victim said their losses were, and I think he decided, look, that's reasonable. That's fair. That's a good way to figure out what the loss is to the victim in this case, because no one has come forward with any alternative means to calculate something different.
Junk in, junk out, huh?
Well.
Well, whatever. I'm sorry.
Tickets in, tickets out. I would briefly like to address the constructive amendment argument just in terms of the brief. I think if the court looks at the Hawley case and the Leahy case, which we've cited both of those in our brief, I think that the court will quickly see that indictment was not constructively.
The other aspect of that is that it doesn't say what everybody says it says. It says now Title 18 of U.S. Code, Section 1343, makes it a crime for anyone, and then it goes through the list. And the last one happens to be the which other things of value. It just what it states is what the statute says. But then he goes back and says, but this is what the indictment says. It seems to me that the court didn't make any error as far as that's concerned.
And I believe, Your Honor, that's exactly what the Leahy case says is, in that case, the instructions mentioned government. It was a VA fraud case, and the instructions for conspiracy mentioned government instead of VA, and they talked about two or more persons when there were only two people that were involved in the conspiracy. The court said, look, it's obvious from the record and from the evidence that they were talking about the VA, they were talking about the two people involved in the conspiracy. The instructions said that you can't be convicted of any crimes that weren't in the indictment. The instructions in this case said that. The indictment went back to the jury, just like it did in this case. And if you look at the Hawley case, which puts even a little bit of more meat on that, both decided before Alano, before we started using the plain error review. The Hawley court, when you had a savings and loan bank fraud case, the 1344 bank fraud instruction also included a way for the jury to convict the defendant under honest services fraud, and the court said, look, there's no way that the jury could have convicted this defendant under honest services without also convicting him of money and property, which was charged in the bank fraud, so it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because you can't have one without the other. So I would argue to the court, just supplementing our brief, that on constructive amendment, one, the indictment wasn't constructively amended, even assuming the court found that it was. Two, it would be impossible to show prejudice because there's no way that the jury could have convicted the defendant for other things of value and not property because the indictment says the whole trial was about these discounted tickets as theft of property from Continental Airlines. If this court doesn't have any more questions about loss, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Elden.
During the trial, Mr. Scher was asked how he came up with, how he decided how much to pay Nieto, who was the Continental agent who was issuing these unauthorized waiver tickets. And in response to that, he started explaining how he would look at the fares. And sometimes he would give Mr. Nieto a flat fee, and sometimes it was a percentage of the fare, depending on how much of disparity. And yes, he said during the trial that he looked at the full coach fare. But he never said that that was an accurate reflection of Continental's loss. The government is putting way too much emphasis on the fact that he says that at one point when he's talking about how much he paid Nieto, he looked at those fares, and that's really clear in the transcript. It's quite clear that there are several options to choose on the fare, and they objected vehemently that these figures were inflated and exaggerated. There was no admission. And Continental never, there is no evidence in this record that Continental said these figures reflect the fair market value. There's not even evidence that they said it reflected their losses. What he says is he used this figure before because a prosecutor had told him to use them in a 1999 case. That's not a reason to come up with a figure, and it doesn't justify this figure. That may have been appropriate in that case, and again, we're talking about figures that were presented during guilt, not figures that were used for loss calculations. And it is not the defendant's burden to show what the actual fair market value of the tickets were. It is the government's burden to answer your question, Mr. Higginbotham. Judge Higginbotham. That is the government's burden. He did demonstrate that there was a problem with the methodology. In cases such as Klein, Jones, Olis, Goss, all of those cases, the defendant did not come to sentencing and prove what the actual loss was. They demonstrated that there was a problem with the methodology, and that's what's happened in this case. I just want to point out that in looking at how do we determine what the law said, there is a 2006 case, which is unpublished, in which the PSR used as its figure, they used the lowest fair amount, and that's United States versus Klaus. And that the defendant used promotional tickets to issue free airline tickets. The PSR used the lowest applicable fare to determine the market value. The defense argued that it should have been the airline's internal valuation of the certificates, and the district court said no, using that fare was a reasonable fare. If the court We think that that Continental can provide a fair market value. If not, we would ask for the lowest fair market value. If not, then we would ask that they come up with a reasonable estimate, and it could be the median of their fares. As in Jones, we have never argued that their figures are inaccurate. We've argued that they use the wrong methodology in choosing the highest figures. There was a legal error in this case based on an incorrect application of the standard. There was an objection, and the government didn't provide the evidence. That's the same thing that happened in Jones, Judge Higginbotham, where the PSR and the government's evidence was just simply insufficient, as in this case, for the court to determine what the actual loss was. In Jones, the PSR had used the Medicare's total reimbursement cost, and this court found that it did not reflect the actual loss, reversed and remanded for them to determine on a case-by-case basis the amounts paid that were unreasonable or greater than the actual cost. We're asking that this court reverse and remand and have the district court make a fair representation of the fair market value on an analysis grounded in economic reality.
Thank you, Ms. Odom. We have your case. Next case is